Good afternoon. This is such a happy occasion and beautiful afternoon. And I'm just so proud and delighted to congratulate our distinguished colleague, Professor Alan Heeger, on his acceptance of the University of California Presidential Chair. The Presidential Chair program was established by the University of California Regents in order, I'll quote, to encourage new or interdisciplinary program development, or to enhance quality in existing academic program of the university. So Alan is a perfect choice. His acceptance of this presidential chair actually honored our institution. Ruth, would you agree? Yeah, Ruth, you know, Alan, whenever he gets any honor, he always mentioned that you are the reason that made it possible. So we want to congratulate you too, Ruth. And for me to describe Alan's achievement, actually that's pretty simple. I just mentioned all the awards he has got, some of the awards, not all of them. Alan is a member of the National Academy of Sciences, a member of the National Academy of Engineering, a fellow of the American Physical Society, and he has received the Oliver E. Buckley Prize for Condensed Matter Physics in 1983 and the Balzan Prize for Science of New Materials in 1995. The Institute of Science Research has published a Science Watch mentioning that Alan is one of the most frequently cited researchers in science. And of course, I have to mention his Nobel Prize. And actually, I have got the, I still kept this picture. I was doing the dinner. And in when receiving this Nobel Prize, Alan was cited as the discoverer and the development in the discovery and development of conductive polymer. You know, when I learned physics, I was also always under the impression that plastics is supposed to be used to insulate electricity. But with fiddling with the Mother Nature, somehow Alan managed to make it electrically conductive. So that's really, he's really a true pioneer. At this point, since I'm talking about Nobel Prize, it's very, very proud that our UCSB would have two other fellow Nobel Prize winners here in the same room, and Professor Walter Cohn. And Professor Alan, Professor Herbert Kroemer right there. Sorry. And I would just want to mention one more prize that Alan received. Alan has been an integral part of this community, this campus community. Aside from being a world-class citizen and community members, also the integral part of UC Santa Barbara community for 21 years now. And he is such an inspiration, such a positive influence to his colleagues and students and the faculty and staff members. We are just delighted and honored to have him on our campus. And for that, University of California, Santa Barbara also had the honor to present him with the award of Santa Barbara Medal. And the inscription of this medal reads, Alan J. Heeger, Polymer Pioneer, Renaissance Man, Nobel laureate, colleague, UCSB proudly salutes you. Alan, UCSB proudly salutes you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on such a warm, beautiful, sunny afternoon at the beginning of a new quarter. Pleasure to, I appreciate your being here. So what's happened? I don't know what's happened, actually. I need help from you. You're the one that got in trouble last time. So I'm not on, despite all our, there it goes, okay. So being a inherently, I guess, a risk taker, I'm going to talk about some things about which I'm not expert. Gene sensors and the detection of specific targeted sequences in DNA. And I found a way to weave into this a little bit of reminiscence on a trip to Stockholm that that perhaps some of you haven't seen. So this lecture is really about a physicist in the process of learning. As my family knows, and many of you know, I started as a physicist. I think I was born as a physicist. I certainly, people tell me, look like a physicist. But I became a chemist. Okay, you know that. I became a chemist both gradually and suddenly. And of course, the suddenly was October 10th of 2000. And I'll return to this picture. But if you look at it very closely, you'll see that it says here that I'm a chemist. And then, of course, trying to learn a little biology. There are many problems in science that are interesting, but not all of them are important. As in most areas of human endeavor, good taste makes the difference. And what's wonderful about research, as I think most of you know, is that with relatively little background knowledge, and in fact relatively few facts, one can make important contributions. Some people think the facts even get in the way. I think that this is a very good reason, or this last point I'm making here is the reason that we like to encourage undergraduates to get involved in research very early. And I think it's the reason, and I think that's what we as faculty do, hopefully, is provide the good taste to the graduate students and turn them loose, because they're the ones that make the progress. And one of the best examples of this that I know of course, is this famous pair. It's nice that this is the 50th anniversary of the prize of the discovery, not the prize. The prize was about 10, Nobel Prize was about 10 years later. This is 50th anniversary of the Watson-Crick discovery of the structure of DNA. And this is, of course, their picture. He was 22, I think, at the time, or maybe 23, something. This is James Watson. This is Francis Crick. And they're standing before this important model. They were not experts, but with a few facts, some good taste, a sense of what was important. They decided this problem that was important. They decided they were going to solve it. And they tripped a little on the way, but as I say, with a lot of chutzpah, they made this incredibly important discovery, which I am told Francis Crick walked into the Eagle Pub at noon of this day and said, "We have discovered the secret of life." Now, one of the things that I enjoy and that I like to promote is interdisciplinary science, and I think in this institution it's not a hard sell. There really are many important opportunities at the interface between physics and chemistry and biology, and maybe some of the most exciting things, but you've got to be careful, because if you really push out into problems at the interface, it almost by definition means that one is not an expert. There are great things to learn, but it's easy to make mistakes, and errors are not tolerated in our world. So if you want to move in a new direction, you need a little help from your friends. So here I want to make an acknowledgement to some of these people who have helped me in getting started here. The first one is my son, Peter, who is been a mentor and a colleague and a collaborator, and taught me a little bit about some of this biology. To people who are not here, Duncan McBranch was a student of mine. He and David Witten made some important discoveries that really got my interest and inspired me to start working in this general area of DNA sensors. Guy Bazan and I have worked together on many problems. Neither of us are expert in, I shouldn't really speak for myself, but in biology or biochemistry, but we've managed to have a great time and I think made some really nice progress that I'll tell you about. Kevin Plaxico is a biochemist here at UC Santa Barbara with whom I've been interacting and we'll tell you about some work that we have done together with a postdoc. Dan Moses has been working with me and collaborating with me for many years and helped me with many things. Chuck Fan is here. He's a postdoc. He's been a principal person involved in the work with Kevin Plaxico on gene sensors. Brent Gaylord is an interesting example of interdisciplinarity. Brent is a student who came in through the materials department, working closely with Guy Bazan, who's a chemist, and the three of us have published together. And Deli Wang is a former graduate student. He's now at Harvard as a postdoc looking for a job. Who knows, maybe he'll come back here. So all these people and others have contributed. And as I said, one really does need a little help in order to do things like this. So let's go back to this. I mean, we were laughing about this last evening. People learn about this now, the structure of DNA in ninth grade biology, and I was already finished with my, I never took biology in college, but university, but with high school, I was already finished with that before it was discovered, so people have an advantage. But you know the story, okay? They discovered the structure of the double helix, and more than that, they of course realized immediately what the implications of that structure were, and if there is a classic sentence that's been written in science, it's the last sentence in their wonderful paper, in which I don't remember the quote, but in which they say it has not missed their attention that this structure will enable replication. So you know what it is, okay? Here's the structure of DNA schematically. These are the four bases that you see here. And the important thing, of course, is that C pairs with G and T pairs with A. And so along here, if you have a guanine, you'll have a cytosine on the other side. And so when they come apart, each one of them has all of the information. This marvelous molecule, macromolecule, is about a meter long for the human genome. And it all gets rolled up into this tiny little space in the nucleus of a cell. Amazing. So, why was that important? Well, I think you all know why that was important, but before that discovery, biologists talked about genes, but nobody knew what they were. After that discovery, it took some time, of course, and that was the subject of a whole series of really important discoveries. But after the discovery of the structure of DNA, it became quickly clear that the genetic code was written there, and the genetic code was identified as written in the sequence of bases along the DNA. That is the specific sequence of C, G, T, and A, a linear code for describing genetic information. Each sequence of bases, three bases, identifies a specific amino acid. As you know, all proteins are made up of 20 amino acids. There are four bases, okay? Four cubed is 64, so it's redundant, but that's been figured out. So sequence of three bases defines a specific amino acid, and then of course the sequence will tell you what the gene is, and the gene is a sequence of bases which specifies a code for a specific protein, and all the proteins that we have that make up us are specified on that molecule. So now we know what a gene is. And of course with the complete mapping of the human genome, this kind of information is becoming known in greater and greater detail. So as I said, there are 3 billion base pairs. They specify, we are told, approximately 30,000 genes, and those genes direct cells to make approximately 30,000 proteins. That's what we are. So there's a need for gene sensors, and this is what I'm going to talk primarily about here. Sometimes there are errors. Sometimes sickle cell anemia, propensity for breast cancer, Tay-Sachs disease, there are many, many, and of course, with the mapping of the human genome, people are really into this now and mining this information to find these errors, identify them with specific diseases. And so we are beginning to know the sequences that identify these errors. Look them up in a library, get that information. Sometimes we're infected. New viruses, for example, in the news these days. We know that strep mutates all the time, so the current strain that is in the hospital needs to be known. So for proper medical response, we need to know which virus, which specific strain. And one by one, these are all becoming known. We know the sequences. We are not all precisely identical. Forensic identification of individuals is, of course, in the news all the time. I'm not telling you anything new. But each individual is different, and we can identify you, or they can identify me, from the sequences. We're on the verge of a revolution in genetically engineered foods, in some cases not being accepted because of fear, but it's going to be important to identify whether it's my product or your product. And how are you going to do that? Well, of course, it's obvious we're going to identify this because I'm going to put my name on from my company onto the gene, onto the DNA that for the wheat that I produce, et cetera. We'll be able to identify from the sequences. And of course, these days, bioterrorism is around, the fear of it is around, and the simple question that was asked, that can be asked any time, was asked last year, is it anthrax or is it flu? Because the symptoms are the same for the first, 24 hours or something like that, but of course the consequences are very different, and we can identify which it is from the sequences. Now methods have been developed to amplify DNA. I think most of you know this. One can start essentially with a single molecule of DNA. And using this wonderful scheme of PCR, polymerase chain reaction, that was discovered by this somewhat unorthodox scientist, Kerry Mullis, in the late 80s, I think it was, he received the Nobel Prize in 1993, enables us, and again, I think it's something you're familiar with, one can take remarkably small samples and grow them into large enough quantities of that molecule, that specific DNA, that one can do a variety of tests to identify. But it's expensive and it's time consuming. So despite the fact that this works, there is a real need for rapid, portable, inexpensive ways to read the base sequences on DNA. We need gene sensors. We'd like to be able to have them inexpensive so that each of us could go to, for example, go to the doctor, to your private physician, and a whole list of tests could be made if it were inexpensive enough. Not sure we'd want to know all the answers, but that'll be possible. So that's what we're talking about. I'm going to tell you about two methods of detecting specific sequences targeted on DNA. One of them has to do with a fluorescence method that I mentioned earlier in the context of Guy Bazan and Brent Gaylord, and the other one is an electrochemical method that I mentioned earlier in the context of Kevin Plaxico and Chuck Fan. So there are two phenomena here, and I'm going to tell you a little physics or chemistry or whatever it is. The first one is called Forster resonant energy transfer, and it was discovered and proposed a little over 50 years ago by a German named Theodor Forster. I'll tell you about that in a minute. And the other phenomenon, the other subject matter, is electrochemistry. And electrochemistry, of course, goes back to Michael Faraday, 1850, laid out the foundations. So let's talk about these, and we're going to use these two, shall I call them phenomena or whatever, bodies of knowledge, and apply them to specific methods for DNA sequence detection. Forster showed in the late, around 1950, that if you have two dipoles, two chromophores, two luminescent species, one with one I'll call the donor or the host, the other I'll call the acceptor, and I'm going to think of the first one as being in its excited state, shown here schematically. And Forster showed that you could get a direct process with the dipole-dipole interaction, straightforward quantum mechanical quantum process where the joint density of states is the emission of the host and the final state is the absorption of the guest. And in order to get this process to go, you have to have conserve energy basically, but you have to have overlap between the emission of the host and the absorption of the guest. And in this little schematic, I've shown that overlap is not bad. It's not perfect, but it's not bad, and it turns out that's good enough to give you reasonably fast energy transfer. Now, the way that works is that overlap comes into this R-naught quantity, which we need to know, and the rate of energy transfer depends here on the natural luminescence lifetime, but you see you can transfer the energy much more rapidly than the natural luminescence lifetime if the distance between the donor and the acceptor is less than this characteristic distance R-naught. If that's true, then you can transfer the energy very efficiently. We're going to want to do that. Okay? And so I need to know this quantity R-naught. So we went after this a couple of years ago, in around 2000. Went back, postdoc Arthur Dogaro went back into Forster's work of 50 years ago, wrote down some simple rate equations that come from equations that he wrote. These are very simple equations that says the time rate of change of the population of the host naturally decays, but also transfers out to the guest, and the time rate of change of the population of the guest will naturally decay, but picks up the energy that's transferred from the host. And so what you find there is schematically something like this, that the fractional population on the host will die rapidly, depending on this quantity R-naught that I mentioned. And as it dies, the guest picks it up and eventually dies later. So we wanted to test this, and we chose a specific system, which is perhaps not so important for this example, for this audience, but we chose a specific system where this was the host and this was the guest, and we did that because in this case, when you probe at ultra-fast timescales, when you probe what's going on, you can get stimulated emission here and photo-induced absorption here. But if you probe here and the energy transfers over to the guest, the signal goes from negative to positive. So it's a very nice little signature. And you can take those equations that I wrote and you can solve them. And you can actually do the pump probe experiments on picosecond timescale. And these are the data. So by fitting, and here's the phenomenon that I showed you or I alluded to, you start off here with photo-induced absorption, you cross over to stimulated emission as the energy transfers from the host to the guest, and the only parameter that we didn't know that we had to get to obtain from the fits to the data was this characteristic distance R naught. So if I have two species that are closer than R naught, I will get very efficient energy transfer. If I have them farther apart than that characteristic distance, it basically won't work because I think I showed you that, but maybe I didn't. Yes, because the rate falls off very rapidly with a characteristic distance of order, goes like the 6th power because of the dipole-dipole interaction. So we know this distance now. And we want to use this to do a specific targeted DNA detection. And this is work that was published a little over a year, not quite a year ago, last summer, using water-soluble conjugated polymers, semiconducting polymers, the sort of thing that I've been playing with for many years, and a different macromolecule that is biologically relevant called peptide nucleic acid. So let me tell you what that is for the few people here who might not know. DNA is an acid. Here's a little piece of the structure. On each of these repeat units, there's a place where you hook one of these bases on, and as we said, could be G or C or T or A. And this spacing between the bases is determined by this molecular structure. DNA is an acid. It's negative charge here because a proton has gone off into the water, into the solution. In the late 80s, I think first initially in Denmark, if I have it right, this PNA, peptide nucleic acid, was synthesized. Really interesting because you see the backbone is completely different. But amazingly, and maybe it was designed, maybe it's an action, I actually do not know. Amazingly, the distance between the bases is almost precisely the same as in natural DNA. So this is neutral because we don't have this phosphate group here, you just have a simple NH. So it's neutral, it's not charged, but one can hook on, of course, the bases, one can make a double helix. Using DNA as one strand and PNA as the other strand. And in fact, because this is neutral, the binding is even a little stronger, of course, than for two DNA chains where you have negative charges on both. So here's the idea, okay? I was walking across campus one day looking for a sandwich, and I saw Guy and Bazan and Brent Gaylord sitting over a piece of paper. And I came over, and this is what they were talking about, okay? So we want to take here a water-soluble, luminescent, semiconducting polymer of the kind that we've been playing with for many years for electronic applications and of the kind that was cited in the Nobel Prize of 2000. And we want to take a little vial of this stuff, okay? It's going to be in water. For those of you who have very good eyes, you know this isn't water, but that's what I could find when I walked out of my office. It's going to be in water. And so we need a water-soluble version of this luminescent polymer, and that's not so difficult, and I can show you how to do that. And then we're going to, basically you can buy a peptide nucleic acid with any sequence that you want. So let's buy one which has a sequence on it which would recognize, for example, the anthrax. And we did that. And then one needs to modify that a little bit in the context of the Fuerster transfer that I told you about before. This is a highly luminescent, blue-emitting polymer. And I'm going to put on the end of this, this is going to be like the host or the donor, and I'm going to put on the end of this little PNA a red-emitting small molecule. Details of it don't matter, it's fluorescein. And the important point here is that because I have a fairly large volume of water, and because I use a very, very dilute solution of both of these entities, then their characteristic distance is separation is very large. Okay, you can do the calculation if you start with a very, very, very dilute solution and there's no specific attraction between the two entities, they'll be randomly spaced, and that characteristic distance will typically be significantly larger than the 30 angstroms that I mentioned a few minutes ago. So as a result of that, if you probe this, you will see blue light. And in fact, there's a little blue light here from the molecule that's in there. But you will not see transfer of the energy. Okay. So what do we do? What we do now is add DNA. We're looking for, what are we looking for? We designed this to have a specific sequence on it. Somebody asked me, how many bases do you need? Okay, well the answer comes out pretty quickly. You have four choices at every site, okay? So if you buy, obtain a PNA which has 15 bases on it, you basically have a big number. You know, 4 to the 15th is a big number. You won't make any errors. So now what's going to be done is to look for the complement to the thing that I put in. I want to find anthrax or whatever it is. So first possibility is you don't have it. Okay. If you do not have it, if what I'm looking for is not there, if it's fortunately not anthrax, then of course the DNA will not, the double helix will not form. So this neutral PNA will just wander around the solution and won't be any closer on average to the luminescent polymer than it was before. On the other hand, if you happen to have the specific strain of strep or the DNA of the anthrax or whatever it is you're looking for, then of course that DNA will bind with the target that I'm looking for. You'll form a little double helix. It's now negatively charged. And if you have done what I suggested here and make the luminescent polymer positively charged, they come together, they're attracted by the Coulomb interaction, they will be at a distance less than 30 angstroms, and you will see this, you see the light coming out red, and you'll know red, not blue, means that you have found what you were looking for, whether you wanted to or not. So in this case, you will not see Fourier, first the resonant fret, and in this case, you will. Now, if you want to do that, one needs to have semiconducting luminescent polymers which are soluble in water. And fortunately, the chemists have come to the rescue to make that possible. We can obtain macromolecules like this, which are water soluble, by taking a core structure, which is, let's say, well known, if you add onto the basic, this is insoluble, completely insoluble, intractable. If you raise it to 400 or 500 degrees C, it will burn up, but nothing you can do with it. If here you put side chains on, which are simple alkyl chains or alkoxy chains, and this likes organic solvents, and this will go into an organic solvent. On the other hand, if you put out here something like I've shown, a salt, SO3 minus lithium plus, then when you try to put that into water, the lithium will go off into solution, it'll go into water. And we can get this, we can make this. In fact, what we used was not that specific structure, because that one, as you can tell if you look at it, the lithium goes off, this would be an anionic chain, negatively charged. We don't want that, we want a positively charged chain. But Bazan and colleagues made that in a different way. In this case, we have on these side chains here a methyl iodide. In this case, the iodine goes off, iodide goes off into solution, leaving a positively charged chain. And here's a whole set of spectra which will tell you that the from this overlap right here between this orange curve and the blue curve, that there's enough overlap for effective Fuerster transfer. And there it is, it works. So if you put in the complementary DNA, you get this huge signal that comes out. In this case, it's kind of orange. If you don't put in the complementary, you get the light only comes out here in the blue. This is basically instantaneous is too strong, but it's very very quick, very specific, and with high sensitivity. Very elegant idea that actually works. In this case, what you're doing is you are using this macromolecule. Can be hundreds of thousands of repeat units to absorb the light very effectively. And quite remarkably, and we actually still do not understand this, the entire chain is able to transmit energy, all the energy that it absorbs in this Fuerster transfer mechanism to the guest. The means of communication within the chain is to me still mysterious, but it works. So that gives you very high sensitivity, and that sensitivity in fact has not even been optimized. So we need, there's a lot of work to be done. We have confirmed that that amplification is there, but in no sense have we optimized it. So there's a lot of work to be done, but there's a possibility that this could be sufficiently sensitive that one does not need to use the PCR of the PCR of Mullis that I described to earlier. Okay. I was telling someone the other day that I learned to ski when I was 32. I got reasonably good at it, I say. I didn't learn electrochemistry until I was in my 40s. Okay. And the only thing I know about electrochemistry I learned it, hope I know a little more now. What I learned about electrochemistry came from, of course, conducting polymers. Around 1978, I think it was, over a lunch actually, Alan McDiarmid and I had this idea that you could dope conducting polymers electrochemically. The formula is shown here, but what happens is you make a little electrochemical cell, you put some electrolyte in, the electrolyte is lithium fluoroborate in this particular case, you put a little external battery on there, and if you make that voltage large enough, you can pull electrons out. Okay, the chemists call that oxidation because it does sort of what oxygen likes to do, and when you pull that electron out and put it over here, in order to make this neutral, this counter ion will go in. It'll stay there. And you have now doped the polymer, and that'll give you charge carriers and electrical conductivity and a whole set of phenomena. And the nice thing is that you can control that. This is really a desktop experiment. You can control that with a little power source, basically a battery. And an ammeter that'll tell you when you've come to equilibrium. So, very, very simple, but in a way, elegant way of doing it. Now, what's going on here is that a semiconductor, which is what I'm talking about here, I'm talking about a semiconducting polymer, but a semiconductor is a remarkable animal in that its chemical potential is not fixed. Because of the fact that there's an energy gap, you can move the chemical potential all around. It's not true for a metal. So if you take something like lithium metal, chemical potential is fixed. Right here at the work function, you can't really move it. So if you do what I had in this previous transparency and have here lithium metal against as the counter electrode, then what you do is that as you change that voltage, you pull the chemical potential down into this band, and when you do that, electrons start going out. You oxidize it. On the other hand, if you lower the voltage, you can pull this chemical potential up into here, and electrons start going in, and you can reduce it. Okay. Somebody has to tell me why this is called reduction. Martin, that's you. You know that. You have to tell me that. Okay. And the way you detect that is you measure the current as you sweep the voltage, and you get some background currents, but when you get everything just right so that this chemical potential is right here, you get an extra current, and you can integrate that current and it tells you how much charge, and as you go back, the electron goes back in, and you can do this many times in a cycle, and that's why it's called cyclic voltammogram. And this is not exactly one for a conducting polymer, but it's one that we use, as you'll see, for DNA detection. But we had a lot of fun with that, with electrochemistry in the early 80s. And we used it to do some new physics, which let me take 2 minutes to tell you about the solitons in polyacetylene. Here's the structure of polyacetylene. There's a carbon, carbon, a carbon, and a hydrogen, and a hydrogen. And it's a very interesting structure, because if you imagine starting off with all of the bond lengths here equal, then this system is not stable. It likes to have a shorter bond, a double bond, and a longer bond, and a shorter bond, and a longer bond. So if you start off at uniform bond lengths, then on an energy diagram you're here, and as you distort toward double, single, double, single, you slide down into this minimum. On the other hand, it's quite obvious that you didn't have to go this way. You could have made, instead of double, single, double, single, you could have made single, double, single, double, and that slides off into this minimum. So we like to say there's a broken symmetry. These two states are exactly, precisely equivalent, but the magnitude of this barrier is proportional to the length of the chain. These chains can have hundreds of thousands of repeat units. So this barrier can be very high, and if you do a back-of-the-envelope calculation, what you'll find out is that the time it takes to tunnel from one minimum to the other quickly, as n gets large, quickly exceeds the lifetime of the universe. It just does not happen. So even though you have a degeneracy here, and they're completely equivalent, there is no resonance between them of the kind that one learns about in elementary chemistry in the context of benzene. What's interesting is if you take the one kind and you make a kink, you make a boundary between single, double, single, double, and double, single, double, single, because then if you count, you know, one, two, three, four electrons. There are four bonds on every one of these places. But right here, where you made the kink, that electron is in a non-bonded state. Because of the uncertainty principle, it will not be located on precisely one side. It'll be spread out. But basically, what's happened here when you join these two pieces together, you change the potential that the electron sees. That potential you can put through the Schrödinger equation crank, and you will find that a new state has been formed in the center of the gap. And of course, that electron is in that state, but the state is an honest solution of the Schrödinger equation. So it's there whether it's occupied singly or not occupied or occupied doubly. And immediately you will see then, if you count with me, that this neutral entity has a spin, and that spin could be up or down, spin 1/2. If you pull the electron out by oxidizing the polymer, then you have charge 0, and charge plus 1, and spin 0, because it's not occupied. If you have two electrons on there, you have charge minus 1 and spin 0. And that's what you expect to find when you dope these polymers, because we were able to show many years ago that energetically it's favorable to form these states rather than just take an electron out from the rigid bands as one might do in a conventional semiconductor. So what does this have to do with gene sensors? Nothing. But it has to do with electrochemistry, and this is where I learned it. And I want to show you two really beautiful experiments. One can make a little electrochemical cell. Details here are important, but I'm not going to go through them. And one can make it transparent and put a very thin film of the polymer here, shine light through it, and as you change the voltage, you start to see the formation of this mid-gap state at roughly half the gap. And because we know the cross-section, this enables you to count the charges. Okay? You integrate the current, you can count the charges. Or you can measure the optical density, and you can count the charges. Similarly, you can make a little electrochemical cell on a very fine capillary, and you can stick that capillary into a electron spin resonance cavity, and you can count the spins. You can use, you know, identical experiment, except now not sensitive to the charges, but sensitive to the spins. And when you do that, you find that this spin-charge relation is in fact true. That the number of spins per charge is less than 10 to the minus 3 experimentally. And you verify that although you made this thing out of an electron and a localized structural kink, it has spin-charge relation which is reversed from that of fermions. Remarkable. Time goes by. 20 years later, we get technology. You know something of that technology, and I'll just remind you that by this time, we've learned how to make metallic polymers soluble. We can spray them out of a can. We learned how to make light-emitting displays that you can fabricate with fairly low-cost methods. We've learned how to make a whole series of molecular structures that have colors of emission that go from purple to blue to green to orange to all the way to red. So, I now have something special. I have a class of semiconducting and metallic polymers that are basically inks. And I can use them to do printing. That is to say, I can print electronics, I can print displays. And that's what's happening now. So for example, one can make displays of the kind that I was showing you here in full color using these materials, using red, green, and blue solutions that are made up of these light-emitting polymers, put them into an inkjet printer not so much different than the one you have at home, but of course in an industrial scale with many, many print heads, and you can print the whole display. Here's an example that was made here in Santa Barbara by DuPont Displays. This is actually a full-scale active matrix display showing a video, and it was printed. And that's exciting. You can do things like, we can print now displays, and people are working on many other technologies as well. So here we go. 2000, they called. You've heard the story. Phone is on Ruth's side of the bed. She said, there's someone on the phone from Sweden. It's 5:45 in the morning, and I said, don't hang up. Herb was, of course, already awake. He'd been called at 3 in the morning. And here's the photograph that I showed you earlier, which it is said that, not only is do I have the good company of Walter Cohn, who started off as a physicist and became a chemist, but Ernest Rutherford also, and it is said that when he learned of this, he said, this is the most amazing transformation that I've ever heard of, something like that. So here I was for 1 minute on, this is of course Times Square. You might ask, why do I have this? It turns out that our niece worked for ABC at the time, and ABC runs this display, which is of course huge, you know, it's all over this building on Times Square, and they have and for whatever reason they have a video they monitor. And then she went back into the record and pulled up this image for us. So this is a famous picture that, again, many of you have seen. I apologize to those of you who have seen it too many times, but Herb and I like it. It is said by many that we are related. I asked, we can't find it, but who knows, you know, my great-great-grandmother and Herb's great-great-grandfather, maybe they did get together, we don't know. So we went to, I'm going to show you a few pictures quickly by way of reminiscence of this trip to Stockholm. This, of course, is my colleague Alan McDiarmid and Hideki Shirakawa, and one of the pleasures of that week is to give these Nobel lectures, and this photograph was taken just after we finished that. This is just before we went down to the ceremony. These two guys are here. As you can see, some of us were doing a little clowning around. At this point in time, I was still the tallest of the three. When they stand up, you'll find out, you will notice that is no longer true. There's been another transformation. I think it's because they grew, not because I shrunk. This, of course, is the ceremony. The royal family is here. That's, I believe, Ruth's head. We're sitting here. The Academy, the Swedish Academy of Sciences, is back here, and the Nobel laureates are here. Whenever they call one of the names, we stand up, and the orchestra and the trumpets do a fanfare, and I tell you, it's far more impressive than was in the film. I like the film, but they didn't come close to what you see here. So this is Joris Alferov, who shared the prize with Herb Kroemer, and this is Jack Kilby, the third of the three who were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2000. Here are the three of us, and then the three who were awarded the prize in medicine are next, etc. Picture that you've seen many times. This is afterward, and I like to show it for a variety of reasons, because I guess the main reason is I want you to figure out which one is the queen. Now, the photo I showed you earlier, in which Herb and I had some vague resemblance, caused us some trouble. Or not the photo, but this two old men with a white beard thing caused us some trouble, because in the Stockholm newspaper one day, I'm quite sure it was Herb's picture and my name under it, okay? And people were stopping us and addressing him as, you know, Alan Heger, et cetera. And what made it worse was that Ruth is walking into the banquet here on the arm of the physics laureate. But it turns out that that wasn't me, that was Herb. And that caused even more confusion because of this resemblance. This is what we saw when we walked in. This is the banquet hall. There are 1,400 people approximately. This is the this is the table. The king is probably here. And we were, you know, along here. Spectacular sight. Well, you know, it's important. Huh? Everyone had 21 inches. They have entertainment. Again, quite spectacular. The lights, as you can see, were dimmed, and these marvelous patterns were shown on the walls and on the ceiling. And this long stairway, which a moment ago you saw Herb Kroemer and Ruth walking down, became the stage and the center of this marvelous entertainment. It was a combination of instrumental and singing, and you can see these beautiful women who are singing here. It was to say the least spectacular. Okay, electrochemistry, right? Let's get back to DNA sequence detection. So this is a very recent work, which was in fact not yet published, but last week submitted. Chuck Fan, Kevin Plaxico, myself. It's a bioelectronic electrochemical DNA sensor. Here's the idea. Again, simple idea. One synthesizes a single-strand DNA, and one makes it such that here at the one end and at the other end, you have complementary bases, so that the single-strand DNA will form a little piece of a helix, okay? But the rest of it just forms this open loop because it's not found a complementary sequence. And then what Fan did was to modify this thing, this DNA, which you can in fact purchase with any sequence on here that you want to detect. And again, we will put on here something we're looking for, a specific strand, strain of strep or the anthrax or whatever gene you want to look for. Modifies this so that it will specifically, in an ordered way, attach to a gold electrode. And then on the other end of this DNA, before you start, you put here a molecule which has a characteristic oxidation-reduction signature, redox signature. And the important point is that when the complementary DNA that you're targeting comes into the scene, all of these things which were not paired become paired by the complementary target. That dominates. This stem loop opens up, and there's a major change in the distance between this redoxable ferrocene, which here is very close to the electrode, and you can easily transfer an electron on and off, and here is very far from the electrode, and you cannot transfer an electrode on and off. So this was the simple idea, again, that was implemented in these experiments, and it works. And that's the cyclic voltammogram that I was showing you earlier. This is the redox of this is the oxidation of the ferrocene. Here's the reduction. Characteristic signal when it's in this state. But when you put in the target DNA, and if it's in fact there, it causes this thing to open up, and it doesn't work anymore. So if you put in a little bit, 30 parts per 30 picomolar, it goes down to here, and then here, at successively higher concentrations of the DNA. Selectivity is excellent, in excess of 10 to the sixth, and it all takes place pretty quickly. That is to say, not instantaneous, but in real time, over a few minutes, one can detect whether or not the targeted sequence is there. Interesting, actually, here that the signal, that is to say, how high this peak is, you know, depends on the concentration. It depends as a log. So that means you have a very wide range of sensitivity. So you can see with one sample all the way from picomolar up to micromolar, I guess, whatever. And I just don't understand that. I don't understand the log, so someone here will probably explain it to me. Again, real time, relatively simple. We think that by making the electrodes into microelectrodes and using microfluidics, that we might get sensitivities. We hope to have sensitivities that are sufficient that one will not need to use PCR, which, as I said, is time-consuming and expensive. So there's a lot of work to be done, but great fun. So Henry took my punchline. He always does that. The punchline is, has the Nobel Prize made you happy? Has it changed your life? And the answer, of course, is yes. So, you know, thanks for the punchline. I lecture like this some recently somewhere, and somebody came up to me after and said, Alan, she's not looking at you. She's looking at this guy over here next to you. I said, this cannot be. I will not let this happen. The reason I'm happy is not only because she's there, it's because I had a lot of very good wine. I complimented her. This is the Crown Princess. I didn't tell you that. This is the Crown Princess Victoria, who will be the Queen of Sweden. I complimented her on her diamonds. She told me that these diamonds came from, in 1800, there was no heir to the throne of Sweden. So the powers of the country went to Napoleon, who was the most powerful man in Europe, of course, at the time. And they asked him to designate a king of Sweden, which he did. And that was one of his 12 marshals, 12 generals. His name was Jean-Baptiste Bernadotte, and that's still the Bernadotte family. And when he went to address a fair, those diamonds, he had 5 of them on his coat. Okay, and now she has them on her tiara. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Questions?
So you showed very nice results of the detection of DNA sequences. It looked to me like you might be able to do the same thing for detecting proteins with a sandwich assay.
It is, of course, interesting to move in more broadly into biosensors. And that's happening in a variety of ways. Bazan and Gaylord and colleagues have applied that concept that I showed you earlier to a specific protein, okay. Kevin has been interested for a long time in protein folding, and so you can sort of imagine that you could play the same game with protein folding and unfolding that you could do here. It's different, but this concept of transfer of energy is being used by McBranch and Witten. They've actually formed a company, and it's really looking very promising that they'll have commercial products out this year. So these ideas are all around, for protein, not just genomics, but as they say, proteomics.
Well, if there are no other questions, perhaps you can use your gene sensors to clue the human bird for once.